This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, why did Spike Lee use his movie to make a hero out of a cop that spied on Black activists? We'll put that question to one of the nation's most respected Black academics. And we'll get an assessment of the impact of the just-concluded national prison strike. But first, a civil rights organization in Washington, D.C. has discovered that the Trump administration has plans to drastically raise the cost of staging protests in the nation's capital. According to Mara Verheiden-Hilliard of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, President Trump's people want to charge protesters for the cost of police and ban demonstrators from the sidewalk in front of the White House.
The Trump administration, through the Department of Interior and Secretary Ryan Zinke, who, as we all know, is an enemy of social justice protest, has put out for comment a new regulatory proposal that is a vast and anti-democratic rewrite of the existing regulations governing access to public space in the nation's capital. And among some of the key measures that they are now proposing are putting essentially what we're calling a protest tax on demonstrations. They want to charge people who demonstrate in the nation's capital, in our iconic public spaces, the National Mall, Lafayette Park, the White House sidewalk, or Lincoln Memorial. They want to charge them fees and costs. And the scope of the fees and costs may be enormous. They have suggested that these might include the costs of their personnel sent to monitor a demonstration, the costs of barricades and fencing that the police would put up around a demonstration or near a demonstration, even if you're not asking for it as a demonstration organizer. So these are really substantial costs. They're also saying that they want to evaluate charging demonstration organizers for what they call harm to turf, which is really the idea that our green spaces, when they're used for public assembly, that somehow is going to hurt the precious grass, and then people have to be charged for actually standing on the grass.
Well, of course, all politicians hate protesters, but is this unprecedented? Has there ever been such an attempt to make protesters pay through the nose for the exercise of their rights?
Not in Washington, D.C., not on federal public land in Washington, D.C. That has never happened here before. And we think that it is a proposal that runs headlong into and at odds with fundamental First Amendment rights to petition the government for redress of grievances. And they've also snuck into this proposal, which was only visible by really doing a line-by-line review, that they want to essentially close the White House sidewalk to protest. They are proposing closing all but a little 5 feet sliver for pedestrian passageway. And, you know, we can all picture those images, those iconic images of picketers and people right in front of the White House, in front of the fence on that sidewalk with placards demanding an end to lynching, for women's suffrage, against the war in Vietnam or Iraq. And now they want to shut that off too. And, you know, Nixon famously had the Metro buses come in and block Pennsylvania Avenue. So it blocked that sight line from demonstrators in Lafayette Park and blocked their access to the sidewalk. But now you have the Trump administration going one further and just taking the land out from underneath our feet entirely.
Well, there is a kind of logic to this progression. Over the years, both the feds and, as you discussed, local authorities have segregated and compartmentalized protests so much that it's a kind of ritual that protesters also collaborate in, and it doesn't resemble protest much at all.
Well, I think, in fact, there's a lot of demonstrations that are extremely meaningful and that really are impactful. I mean, when you think about people that were pouring out into the streets in the initial months of the Trump administration, people coming out, going into airports, coming to Washington, D.C., there were a lot of people who were engaging in political life who'd never done so before and were becoming active and realizing that the Democratic Party was not going to be a response to the Trump administration. But very quickly over the past year, you could also see where this all turned into sort of the Democratic Party then, who at first were saying, oh, we want to give him a chance to succeed and we're going to try and work with him, really coming in behind the movement of people in the United States who were opposing the misogynist and racist and reactionary anti-worker programs of the Trump administration, and people are really demobilized. So I do think that there are different kinds of demonstrations. There are some that are more symbolic than others. But I also think the demonstration activity remains a necessary and critical component of social justice activism in the United States. When there are people who see people outside in the streets standing up for what they believe in, when people are on the move, when they are marching, other people come out and they say, yeah, okay, I can make common cause with that. And that's when the people take charge in their own hands, as opposed to sitting back and waiting for politicians to tell them what to think or what to do, or to think that your only answer is going to be at the ballot box. So these efforts to demobilize people that come both from politicians because they can't control mass protest, and also that are now coming from the administration that are trying to make demonstrations too expensive, too inaccessible. On the heels of this, there's an announcement now that the D.C. subway system, the metro system, is considering actually charging rush hour fees during times of demonstration. So you can see that these types of efforts are going to make it very difficult for people to be able to take to the streets unless they're taking out their checkbook. So we're doing everything we can to stop them. We are planning our own legal response here at the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. We're asking people all over the country to go to the comment site and submit comments in opposition to this plan that's been put forward in the Federal Register. And at our website at justiceonline.org, we have information about both a petition campaign and how to link to that comment site where you can tell the government what you think of this plan, that you're opposed to it.
Theoretically, what's the timeline on this? How soon might this be imposed?
Well, there are different steps they have to go through. The first is putting this up for public comment. The closure of the White House sidewalk is already written into proposed regulations, and the proposal to tax, do a pay-to-protest plan, is put forward seeking general comment. So people have until October 15th to go to regulations.gov, which is where you can comment, or there's a direct link on our website at justiceonline.org that'll take you to the exact comment page. And it's critical that they hear from as many people across the country as possible that we are opposed to this plan, that it's an anti-democratic plan, that it is violative of fundamental First Amendment rights. They put this out for comment. The government is required to consider the comments that they receive from the public, and then they have to respond to those comments in their next steps. So we really urge everyone that it's critical to make your voice heard in this process.
The Black is Back Coalition, an organization with which I'm affiliated, is planning its annual March on the White House and protest at Lafayette Park in the first week in November. Might it potentially be affected by this?
No, I don't think that these regulations could possibly come into effect by then, and they have not laid out the specific plans for how they intend to tax protesters. They have put forward the idea that they want to do it, and they want to hear from people about what we think about the idea of charging demonstrators. The closure of the White House sidewalk has been put forward as a regulatory proposal that they're hoping will take effect. We plan to do everything we can to stop that from taking effect. I don't believe that that would impact a demonstration in November.
Well, this really puts the bill in the hands of the police, because the police are the ones who decide how much manpower and resources to bring to a given demonstration.
That's right. And what happens here is that the proposal, as we see it, in addition to being fundamentally anti-democratic and dangerous and restrictive of First Amendment rights, additionally gives discretion to the police for certainly an ample amount of these charges. So that when that happens, it's unconstitutional because discretionary charges can be used as a proxy for content-based discrimination. So the police can look at a demonstration and say, well, we've decided that we're going to ring this demonstration with bicycle fencing or ring the object of a demonstration with bicycle fencing. Now, are they going to charge that back to demonstrators? They could use that to ramp up charges against any type of free speech activity. And these after-the-fact charges, looking at the, quote, harm to the grass, as if our grass is just an ornamental lawn that wealthy people are letting us walk on, is very dangerous. I mean, if you have a mass demonstration and you have hundreds of thousands of people, which is what you would want to have happen, are they going to come back and say, well, our grass doesn't look as good as it did yesterday, and then charge you for it?
And conversely, if there is a support your police demonstration, the cops might decide, well, it doesn't need heavy policing at all.
Right. And to that point, in fact, when the National Park Service and the General Services Administration support the presidential inaugural committees who come in and have their mass inauguration events and they have exclusive access to wide swaths of federal property throughout Washington, D.C. and up and down Pennsylvania Avenue, where they put up bleachers and then they charge money for those bleachers, and they take in money from their wealthy donors and their supporters, and they have people on the grass and the lawn. Those costs are not absorbed by the Presidential Inaugural Committee. They're absorbed by us, the taxpayers, and they make a lot of money off of this. The Trump inauguration, they made more than $100 million, the Presidential Inaugural Committee did, through donations from their wealthy corporate backers and donors and supporters. And, you know, the costs of all of this are charged back to the taxpayers. So the fact that when it comes to free speech activities, which is the one thing that we can do as a people, when we can't afford to take out, you know, and don't control the airwaves and the mass newspapers, but we can control having a lot of people come together and make noise, they want to charge for that.
So free speech ain't free, at least in Trump's vision of the world.
That's right. I mean, that's the fundamental issue here, is if you have to pay for free speech isn't free.
That was constitutional rights lawyer Mara Verheiden-Hilliard of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. Spike Lee's movie, Black Klansman, made a hero out of black former policeman Ron Stallworth, who spied on both the Ku Klux Klan and black political activists back in the 1970s. Black activist, entertainer, and filmmaker Boots Riley wrote an essay blasting Spike Lee for glorifying the police spy. We spoke with another prominent black social critic. Robin D.G. Kelly is a professor of history at UCLA and a prolific author and essayist. The Boots Riley essay on Spike Lee's movie really sparked Dr. Kelly's interest.
You know, I just wrote a piece about Sorry to Bother You that just came out in Boston Review yesterday. And it's a kind of a lengthy piece. And the last part of it deals with Boots's critique, which I think is actually brilliant and misunderstood in some ways. So specifically, what Riley's saying in that piece isn't simply that he disagrees with the film, but it's really about the question of what does it mean when you revise the truth to such a degree that you eliminate the role that Ron Stallworth played or potentially played in undermining black organizations and then transform him and the police department into heroes who are the front line against the Klan. And I think this to me is a really important issue because in some ways the police, state violence has done much more damage to black people over the last, you know, quarter century than very specific white supremacist organizations that we take pride in driving out of our communities. I mean, I'm not saying that they're not dangerous, that white nationalists are not part of the struggle that we're trying to push against, but I'm also saying that it basically erases state violence in some ways. The other thing that I did some research on Stallworth for the piece that I wrote in Boston Review, although I never made it in. And Stallworth is a very problematic character. And a lot of the people, even in the hip hop community, didn't take a critical stance. Like, for example, there's an interview with him on the website OK Player that describe Stallworth as hip-hop's cop, as if, as if hip-hop has a cop who represents them. And why? Because he wrote these books about rap music. He wrote a book called Gangster Code, which is about kind of sociology of gangster rap, and another book called Bring the Noise, which was partly about Tupac's death, but about what he calls the dynamics of Black social revolution. But they're really books that published by a police publishing company that specializes in police literature. And they were written to sort of speak to cops, to authority figures, to say, okay, these are the things we need to be concerned about. These are the things you shouldn't worry about, as if it's translating for these state authorities, like how to deal with potential gangsters. This figure, Stallworth, is very problematic, and Booth was the only person, I think, who had the courage to come out and say, you know what, you need to pay attention to who this person is, as opposed to just sort of letting it go. And the final thing I'll just say about that was that people, I think, misread Booth's critique. And from my reading, he was concerned, again, with the particular ways in which the fictionalized Stallworth story, but also he wasn't getting down in the whole good cop versus bad cop debate. Like, he's not playing that game, but instead focuses our attention on this larger question, and that is, what has been the function of the police in relationship to our own struggles for land, bread, freedom, justice, and power?
Yes, I live in northern New Jersey. The Ku Klux Klan is no threat to Black folks up here. The police are a constant threat.
Right, exactly. And this is Booth's point. If the police are our last line of defense against the Klan, and you end the film with images of Charlottesville, which, again, I'm not saying that that wasn't a real struggle, but I'm saying that that completely reorganizes the way we think about state violence and what we're up against. And contrast that with Booth's film, Sorry to Bother You, which is a broad critique of capitalism proper and its relationship to not just state violence, but to like institutions like the academy, to science, to the fact that we can live in a world where a figure like the main protagonist in Sorry to Bother You, Cash Green, could rise up the corporate ladder and rep as a kind of successful Black person. And yet he's working for a company that is far more dangerous than a group of white supremacist bloggers. That is exactly the issue.
Yes, in this new order, the corporate state doesn't seem to have much problem with employing Black operatives, having Black heroes, and being protected often by Black folks with guns.
Exactly. That's true. Very much.
What was somewhat upsetting in Spike Lee's movie was not just Stallworth, but his whole little clique of cops around him. It reminded me of Barney Miller, that kind of cop force, which I could not imagine in 1971 actually existing, except
right.
on television.
Exactly. And we know that historically. I mean, that's where, you know, it's funny you mentioned Barney Miller, because, I mean, I'm of the generation where I remember that show. And it was a perfect example of a kind of full multiculturalism, you know, where the interior of the police precinct becomes this place where you have sympathetic cops, complicated cops, you know, you get to see their quote-unquote humanity, but you don't see the violence. You don't see the fact that in the 1970s, more and more Black and brown people are being arrested on drug charges, possession charges, even loitering charges, let alone those who are being arrested because of their political activities. None of that stuff exists in the world of Barney Miller, you know, and it makes police officers friendly, grandfatherly, intellectuals, funny, and it erases the kind of violence that people are facing on a day-to-day.
Yes, Abe Vigoda couldn't kill anybody.
Right.
In many ways, this seemed to be Spike Lee's anti-Trump movie. And you were surprised as anybody when Trump was elected. Trump got a majority of white votes, including a majority of white women's votes. But that's rather routine. The GOP almost always gets majorities of white votes. So why is Trump different?
Yeah, well, I've been trying to make the argument that Trump isn't that different. It's definitely a break. I think every single regime has its own distinctive characteristics. But I do think that Trump, in some ways, is a culmination of the failure in some ways, or success, depending on what side of the class divide you're on, of 4 decades of neoliberal policies. So that Trump, in some ways, represented, you know, things have changed a little bit, but represented all the key components that have driven U.S. policy for the last 4 decades. 1, upward redistribution of wealth. 2, the kind of tax policy that puts the burden of social services on the backs of the poor as they deny them those basic services. And in some ways, that doesn't undercut the state, but reorganizes the state to focus on issues that are about protecting private property, that are providing support for corporations, and engaging in forms of policing and militarism. And as much as, in the third thing, as much as Trump poo-pooed free trade policies, here's someone who got rich off of them and continued to maintain them. I mean, this whole chimera around revising NAFTA, when it's really no revision at all, it's simply the reinstitution of it with slight changes, but it's still free trade policies. And then the final thing is that for all of Trump's claim to being isolationist, you know, being against U.S. intervention, this is as much U.S. intervention in war as it was in the Obama administration. So all this stuff's consistent. This is what I worry about, and that is what we're paying attention to. So we end up paying attention to Trump's, I shouldn't say we, not all of us. Clearly your listeners don't. but a lot of people, so-called liberals and so-called leftists, are paying attention to Trump's crimes and misdemeanors, to the question of Russia. They ultimately ignore what are really the essential issues, not just in terms of U.S. foreign policy, but in terms of day-to-day policing and killing of Black people, the whole range of policies that are destroying whatever's left of social life in our community, whether it's environmental issues, dispossession, housing, the fact that we can have a so-called robust economy, and yet more and more people are being put in prison, and not only that, are without jobs, or jobs that actually pay a living wage. We have a continued struggle, among, you know, Fight for 15 and struggles with the grassroots to try to improve the lives of low-wage workers who have historically been unorganized. And what are we doing? You got people who call themselves leftists who feel compelled to defend Attorney General Jeff Sessions, to defend the FBI, to defend NAFTA against Trump. And people who are also saying, you know, what we need is someone like a McCain. I mean, just how absurd it is. This is the function of Trump. Trump, in some ways, could embody many of the policies that are consistent with the last 4 decades of U.S. domestic and foreign policy. But then when it comes down, he becomes a foil. So that John McCain, the same drill baby drill John McCain, is an American hero. The same one who consistently voted to reduce federal funds for renewable and solar energy, the same John McCain who opposed the federal minimum wage laws, the same one who actually supported overturning Roe v. Wade, the same one that actually drafted the agreement to deny habeas corpus to so-called enemy combatants, while at the same time granting immunity to U.S. officials who engaged in torture, the same one who's supposed to be against torture. He did this in 2006. The same McCain who proposed military intervention to overthrow governments he deemed rogue states, including Iran. I mean, he's a hero. I mean, this is how absurd it is, so that we could vilify Trump, and then that vilification of his excesses and his ignorance and his crimes then ends up elevating all these other people who are criminals to the status of hero. So we're in a very dangerous moment. And to me, that is the greater threat. This kind of tunnel vision is a greater threat than specifically what Trump has done as an individual. You know what I'm saying? Does that make any sense?
Yes, just as Spike Lee, in what is essentially his anti-Trump film, glorifies cops, we see anti-Trump forces, including black folks, including people who call themselves progressives, now glorifying the FBI, the CIA, and all these other nefarious characters that they wouldn't be caught dead with prior to Trump.
That's right.
This is a real warping, however, of people's political stances. What does that say about a politics that can be so warped just because of the intrusion of a flamboyant orange racist like Trump?
Well, that's a really good question. I think part of the answer has to do with the way we have responded to crises. In some ways, I think we end up looking at the wrong thing. Trump is a shiny object. And sometimes you get caught up in the shiny object and you miss all the real issues that are going around you, going like right in front of us. And we end up, I think in some ways, confusing reform and catharsis. That is making certain minimal changes that don't change the structure, but may make us feel much better. Catharsis, meaning the catharsis of being able to attack Trump, being able to mobilize masses and masses of people to say down with Trump Pence without actually moving toward revolution. And if you think about revolution, and again, let's keep coming back to Boots Riley, who is serious about this idea of revolution, you've got to think about an overturning of a whole system. So what we end up dealing with is like, it's as if self-styled white nationalists or the Trump people constitute the primary threat. And they're not the primary threat. They're a threat, but not the primary threat. When Trump is gone, we'll still be dealing with the same stuff. Unless we can figure out how to get to the root and be focused and not get caught up in the shiny objects and understand that. And there are movements that do this, then we're going to always be drawn to what I think of as distractions. I mean, I'll give you one really, really, really sort of concrete example, but not to be so abstract. On just on the basis of voting, I'm not a believer, but voting does matter in the sense that we have these interesting candidates like Andrew Gillum and others, and then you have Jackson, Mississippi, which is another interesting issue, where people can use the ballot to be able to win very local victories, sources of power, even if that power is ultimately compromised to a certain degree. However, if you think about the way that we've been talking about Trump's election and all this focus on Russia without looking at the ways in which in a place like Detroit, for example, or the state of Michigan, tens of thousands of black voters were disenfranchised. Their votes didn't count. They weren't counted for lots of different reasons, which people could look up. The loss of those votes, far more significant in swaying. Because, you know, Trump won Michigan. I think he won about 10,000 votes. And he got like 50, 60,000 votes of black Detroiters or Detroiters who didn't count. See, those are the kinds of things that may be a small thing, but that's a very concrete thing that we need to pay attention to. A place like Florida, where you got like, I don't know how many millions of people who have been disenfranchised because they're convicted felons with no method to restore their citizenship, no process. So here we have like, whether you believe in the Constitution or not, just straight up unconstitutional practices denying, and once again, disenfranchising black and brown voters, specifically black voters. And the consequences are, this is how we get people like Trump. Now, had Hillary been elected, we've been dealing with a lot of the same stuff, but no one would be upset about it. because they would see this as a symbolic victory, because we get caught up in symbolism. But I don't want to lose the fact that this focus on foreign agents end up, as it has been doing for the last 200 years in this country and more, ends up being a chimera for what's happening behind the scenes in terms of the continued anti-Black racism, the disenfranchisement, the denial of citizenship rights that have actually had a significant impact on our capacity to elect people who, even in limited government, can actually stand up for some things that many of us believe in.
Well, people seem to forget that in Michigan, in Detroit, and all of the other largely Black cities in Michigan, those populations were disenfranchised in the decade previous to 2016 by the appointment of local managers to manage these city governments. So your vote meant nothing in terms of home rule in Detroit or Flint or any of those other cities.
That's right. That's how the polluted Flint River, as your listeners know, become the water source, not through the city council, but through unelected so-called emergency financial managers. And the criteria to be an emergency manager in Michigan was like a little bit of business school and 1 week orientation. And you basically didn't have to have anything to serve in that capacity. And the people did not elect you. And so we're dealing with some serious violations of people's basic rights. UN investigations would treat the U.S. as a rogue state because of these practices. And meanwhile, we're also dealing with a regime. To be fair, there are some things that are pretty extreme about the Trump administration that, at least even under Obama, they pretended not to deal with. But like the fact that there is not only no recognition of international law, or the ICC, or those kinds of international legal institutions that are responsible, allegedly responsible for defending the rights, human rights of other people and upholding Geneva Conventions, that sort of thing. Even though Obama sometimes ignored those things, the Trump administration is just coming straight out in your face and saying, we don't recognize any of these courts. We're above the law. There's no such thing as international law. And don't ever consider investigating our practice.
That was author and UCLA professor Dr. Robin D.G. Kelly speaking from Los Angeles. Supporters of Mumia Abu-Jamal are optimistic that the nation's best-known political prisoner stands a good chance of winning a new trial. Mumia charges that his conviction in the death of a Philadelphia policeman was obtained through prosecutorial and judicial bias involving former prosecutor Ronald Castile. Those charges were the subject of a court hearing on August 30th. We spoke with Professor Johanna Fernandez of the campaign to bring Mumia home.
Essentially, the hearing was postponed because at the 11th hour, our attorneys were made aware of a new document that surfaced. The document had been in the possession of the DA all along for a number of months, if not a year. And that document is a letter written by an assistant DA under the office of the DA in question, who was turned politician judge, DA Ronald Castile. So this assistant DA wrote to a local state politician identifying a number of prisoners who should certainly be executed. And on the top of that list was Mumia Abu-Jamal. So this is a very important document that could prove, if you know there's anything to be proven, that DA Ronald Castile was directly involved in some important part of Mumia's case. So because this document emerged at the 11th hour, our attorneys asked for more time to present that document, to study it and present it in the context of larger arguments that would prove Judge Ronald Castile's unconstitutional behavior, that he was involved in prosecuting Mumia as a DA and refused to recuse himself from Mumia's case when the case was presented to him at the time that he was judge in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And of course, Mumia and his attorneys presented a number of issues to that court under appeal, violations of his case, and Judge Ron Castile denied all of the issues presented on appeal. So our next gathering at the courtroom is on October 29th, and this case is definitely heating up. Clearly, the powers that be, their side is crumbling. Documents are emerging left and right that should have been released many months ago. And so the battle continues. And if there is a break in Mumia's case, given all of the attention that we see around mass incarceration, repression, the broken character of this system that cannot be defended, there is going to be a massive conversation in the United States and in the world about the unsustainability of this modern form of slavery.
And so just to continue through that lens of prison slavery, with this hearing having occurred right in the middle of a nationwide prison strike called on by the enslaved organizers inside of prisons throughout the country, the carnage that occurred inside of Lee Correctional Facility in South Carolina, what do you see emerging out of this prison strike, which officially ended on September 9th, though there are reports of continuous strike activity? How would you connect that to this crumbling edifice that you referred to and the disarray that we see with regard to the other side?
Well, I think one of the most important developments in the last number of months is that imprisonment has finally entered public discourse in the United States, and the perspective of prisoners is finally being discussed in a way that does not dehumanize the prisoner. So, as your audience knows, the strike was covered in the mainstream media, and the prisoners managed to break through. I think that it's important to identify their reasons for fighting, their kind of why we fight. They essentially are fighting because they're treated like animals, because prisons are war zones, because they are daily hurt by conditions of confinement. And I'm quoting from their documents, which says that, quote, "For some of us, it's as if we're all dead. So what do we have to lose?" unquote. And this is their explanation for why they're engaging in resistance that was going to elicit a draconian repression on the part of the state. So I think one of the important things to emerge from the strike is that the language used by prisoners themselves was picked up by the media. So the media referred to them as imprisoned humans, and that's what they refer to themselves as. They are clearly protesting slave wages. In a place like Louisiana, prisoners get paid 4 cents an hour. They're protesting, of course, the 13th Amendment, which essentially says that enslavement as a form of punishment is allowed for prisoners. And they're also protesting Clinton-era policies that worsened prisoners' lives as a result of the 1994 and 1996 crime bill passed by Clinton, which essentially made it harder for prisoners to get rehabilitation, but it made it harder for them to litigate against violations against prisoners. So their demands are wide-ranging, and we were able to read this for the first time in the public sphere. And we have to ask the question, why is this happening now? Clearly, they learned some lessons from the last strike, which happened 2 years ago. And part of what they noted was that there was a media blackout. And this time, they used phones to talk to journalists from the inside. They had press conferences with journalists, a number of journalists at a time, and they did a phenomenal job reaching out to their supporters on the outside. So I think part of what's going on, too, is that we're living in the era of Trump. And Trump's draconian violation of every right imaginable has probably given people of conscience a sense that if we tolerate violence and repression in the prisons or in any area of life, that's going to come back to bite us. Because if you tolerate the dehumanization of anyone in society, that erodes the fabric of freedom and liberty in society as a whole. And that is an issue and point that is probably more obvious to people of different walks of life and across the political spectrum today than it was before this Trump moment.
Speaking of this widespread repression that goes on, especially on these prison plantations, since late August, in fact, right before Mumia's August 30th hearing, the entire state of Pennsylvania's prison system of 25 facilities was put on lockdown. And we are told by various sources in the foggiest language that essentially, this was due to some sort of mass outbreak of secondhand substance toxification, wherein prison overseers and other staff within these facilities were somehow just dropping like flies. There doesn't seem to be any coherent narrative as to why this lockdown has occurred, but certainly it has occurred, was only lifted recently, and now these draconian measures that you speak of are being targeted toward Pennsylvania. More quietly, these measures have also occurred within Ohio and Maryland, which was locked down for at least a day. What have people been saying in Pennsylvania about the lockdown? And what is your interpretation of this statewide lockdown in Pennsylvania that only just recently ended?
So as people know, lockdowns in prisons mean that prisoners are confined to their cells 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There's absolutely no movement in the prisons. And in Pennsylvania, it seems that these reported and alleged illnesses among guards was used to justify an unprecedented unleashing of repressive measures that essentially are going to stop or have already stopped the delivery of any books to the Pennsylvania prisons. There will be and there is no mail being delivered to any facility in Pennsylvania. Now the mail is being rerouted to a Florida-based contractor that is digitizing the mail and sending it to the prison digitally, and prisoners will get a copy of whatever mail they received, including legal mail. And for the next 90 days, there will be absolutely no food in the vending machines allowed during visits. And, you know, this presents a problem for prisoners who have diabetes. And many prisoners have diabetes, unfortunately, because of the horrific food they eat. So not eating while they get a visitor, and you're usually with a visitor for three, four, 5 or 6 hours is dangerous to their health. So again, part of what they're instituting is $15 million worth of repressive technology, including high-tech body scanners, drone detection equipment, and other insane things. This is costing the state $15 million, and the state somehow manifested $15 million in 2 days. This at a time when they say that they don't have the money to treat prisoners with a cure for hepatitis C. So we have to ask the question, where is this coming from? And I'm saying that it's a pretext because toxicologists at the Perelman School of Medicine, that's the School of Medicine of the University of Pennsylvania, right? Top institution in the state. They said about this supposed poisoning of guards by secondhand contact with drugs, they call this, the doctors and the researchers and toxicologists, quote, an example of mass psychogenic illness, which is essentially contagious hysteria on the part of the guards that's fueled by fears of dangerous exposure. And part of what they said, these doctors, was that they see this all the time with law enforcement, that law enforcement shows up in, you know, the emergency room. They think they're dying. And in fact, this is a psychological response to perceived fear. They said that this happens often among police officers. So I think that, you know, part of what we were discussing previously is what's the fallout of all of this that's happening in the prison and the coverage of this in the mainstream media. I don't remember the last time that an institution like the University of Pennsylvania has pretty much exposed and contradicted the policies of the state in this direct and transparent a form. So essentially what the doctor said was that this is bogus. They said that of the 57 guards who claimed to have been poisoned, only 7 of them got the medication that's supposed to reverse the drug poisoning. And what they said is 57 people were supposedly infected. 7 of them got the medication that we administer, but these 7 people that we administered the medication to, they were talking to us. And if you're talking to anybody, if you're not unconscious, you don't have any poisoning. It's psychological. So, you know, this raises questions about whether this is a real thing that happened or whether it was pretext. And certainly Mumia Abu-Jamal, who has written about this because he's a prisoner in Pennsylvania, has called it pretext. Now, there is a lot of drug trafficking in prison, but we need to look at the guards themselves because it's the guards who bring drugs into the prison and benefit handsomely from that lucrative underground business.
Yes, and as you point out, this kind of mass hallucination on the part of prison slavers seems to have everything to do with fear, especially fear of retribution. And we can recall that this same kind of mass hysteria certainly occurred in places like Virginia after the Nat Turner Rebellion. Speaking of this question, we know that right now there are a number of facilities within South Carolina, within evacuation zones to Hurricane Florence, that are not being evacuated. Facilities such as McDougal Correctional and others. What do you make of this form of repression wherein human beings are not being evacuated from a deadly storm that has already claimed the lives of at least 13 people? How do you fit that into this broader context? And where do you think we need to go from here?
Well, I think we have to say that this is an example of the utterly morally bankrupt nature of the system of 21st century capitalism that we're living in. It's just indefensible and barbaric. it's fascinating that the prisons are imprisoning so-called criminals, but the state itself deploying terror and criminality on a mass scale. And in these situations like a hurricane, that becomes pretty clear, especially as we compare how the United States addresses this problem of imprisonment in the case of a natural disaster and how states like Cuba, for example, handle evacuation. In Cuba, prisoners and poor people don't die during hurricanes because the state makes it a priority to evacuate, and they employ everyone in society to make sure that everyone lives under these conditions. So we know that some states have evacuated, like North Carolina, but South Carolina is refusing to evacuate, in part because prisoners' lives don't matter. Black people who are disproportionately imprisoned in the South, they don't matter. But also because at a moment when the least among us are rebelling, that signals danger to the powers that be. I think that we have to consider that this strike was covered in the mainstream news and prisoners were going out on strike. It seems that in a moment of crisis in the United States, economically, politically, in terms of basic rights, the only folks who are exercising and using and deploying their labor power are prisoners. And ultimately, that has the potential to capture the imagination of those on the outside. And so this resistance from inside the walls has to be silenced, has to be repressed, because it's clear that the system, the political system, the economic system is weak. When you have to deploy force and barbarity, as we are seeing being deployed in the prisons on a mass scale, that's a sign of weakness. And so part of what we're seeing is overstretch and an overbite on the part of the state. And so, you know, it's up to us who are outside to amplify, to continue to amplify the voices of people who are risking everything to stand up for their basic humanity. And now that the media, that journalists are paying attention, this is the moment to really tie what's going on in the prisons with the insanity of the system, which an increasing number of people in American society are feeling in their daily lives.
Dr. Johanna Fernandez is a professor of history and African American studies at New York's Baruch College and an activist with the campaign to bring Mumia home. In an essay for Prison Radio, Mumia Abu-Jamal says the state of Pennsylvania has put the U.S. Constitution on lockdown.
It happened on the last Wednesday of August, 2018. Around 8:30 p.m., the PA system announced a lockdown of the prison, apparently in response to a recent spate of staff sicknesses thought to be related to drugs. Even though the suspected cases occurred in prisons in the western part of Pennsylvania, the entire state system, almost 30 prisons, went into immediate lockdown. Lockdown means no movement in the prison except for staff. That means all prisoners are locked in their cells for 24 hours a day. All visits were canceled. Mail delivery and outgoing mail was canceled. Several days into this process, guards distributed a 3-page memo to prisoners announcing new rules allegedly designed to defeat drug smuggling. Among them, prisons will no longer receive mail, for all correspondence will be rerouted through an address in St. Petersburg, Florida. That office will scan and copy the mail and then send a digital copy back to Pennsylvania. Legal mail will be Xeroxed and a copy given to the prisoner named in the mail. For 3 months, no visitor can purchase food or photos for a prisoner, and no books can be ordered by a prisoner. The DOC, it appears, is having a temper tantrum, and it is engaged in war against all contact with the public. This sounds like the DOC's equivalent of reefer madness. This is, more than anything else, Pennsylvania's DOC's engagement in drug politics. It's a war against the prisoners, yes, but also a war against knowledge and ultimately the Constitution itself. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network. Thank you.